Thank you. Beethoven's B flat major piano concerto number 2. Although it was the first one he wrote and repeatedly revised, you just heard it played here at the BBC Proms by our visitors from Norway, pianist Christian Ile Hadland and the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra with its Russian chief conductor Vasily Petrenko, and Beethoven's own first movement cadenza, as Hadland was telling us just before the performance. Well, he leapt to his feet as soon as he'd finished and immediately shook hands with conductor and everyone he could reach amongst the strings. Huge grin on his face as he comes back onto the platform. Christian Ile Hadland, his concerto debut at the Proms. He was telling Sean Rafferty on In Tune yesterday, not only had he never been to a prom before, but today was actually his first visit to the Royal Albert Hall, and he was telling me this morning that he was loving the space and the sound, and that, well, he wasn't nearly as nervous as he'd feared. He said he felt much more nervous for his Proms chamber music concert last week with his fellow new generation artist, the Signum Quartet, at Cadogan Hall. And he told me that he normally felt less nervous for chamber music, but it felt like it got his Proms debut nerves out of the way early. Obviously no sign of them this evening. Off they go again. Petrenko applauding as he follows in Hadland's wake. And his next concert, in fact, the next concert for all of the musicians on stage today, is tomorrow in Dublin. Not Beethoven, though. They wanted something Nordic. So, guess what? It's going to be Grieg's piano concerto tomorrow. Back he comes, Christian Ile Hadland. They're still cheering. I wonder if he's going to do the traditional thing on his debut. He is. We're going to have more music. Music by Couperin for Christian Ile Hadland's encore here at the Proms this evening. I think that's the TikTok shot. It's originally for two manual harpsichords, which makes it quite complicated for the hands of the pianist on a single manual, the fingers interlocking, quite interesting. I couldn't actually see from here because he's got his back to me on the platform, but that's what I remember. Well, his 2 years as a Radio 3 New Generation artist is coming to an end. The next six young artists were announced just yesterday on In Tune, and the artists for 2013-15 include the Danish string quartet, and two pianists as well, one from China, one from Switzerland. All six of them coming to a radio near you soon. Exciting times ahead for them and us, as I'm sure Christian Ile Hadland would be only too happy to tell you after his 2 years as a New Generation artist. Off he goes again. obviously enjoying his concerto debut here at the Proms. Well, Beethoven's second piano concerto had its first public performance in Vienna in 1801. In the same city, exactly 80 years later, Anton Bruckner's Romantic Symphony, his fourth, was given what was for him an unusually successful premiere. And that's the single work we're going to hear in the second part of this evening's Prom. And the interval gives us a chance to find out more about Bruckner and his background in our 20-minute Proms Plus introduction. Just before this evening's concert, I was joined on stage at the Royal College of Music by writer, broadcaster and music historian Roderick Swanston and by Canon Klaus Sonnleitner, who's following in Bruckner's footsteps as monastery organist at the Abbey of St. Florian. We're here to find out more about Anton Bruckner before we listen to his romantic fourth symphony in this evening's Prom. Roderick Swanston, even in a symphony like the fourth, we can't escape ideas of church belief and faith, or at least that's what this evening's conductor Vasily Petrenko told me.
Well, one of the great things about Bruckner is you can read almost anything into it. I mean, we know that he was a deeply religious man, deeply Catholic religious man, and his belief obviously got into his church music. But there is no evidence that they got into the symphonies unless you make a little leap between it. And in fact, Bruckner left a rather fragmentary programme when he revised the symphony in the late 1870s. And here it has nothing to do with church, it has with medieval knights. The problem with, it's not that you can't read a religious thing into it. The trouble is if you do, then you make it sound like evensong. So it gets very slow and sepulchral, and it has an ideology built into it, into how you're going to interpret it. So I get my stopwatch out tonight to see whether he's gone into ecclesiastical mode.
Now, Klaus Sonnleitner, you're the organist at Bruckner's old church, the Abbey of the Augustinian Monastery of St. Florian in Linz. I should say near Linz, because it's not actually in the city. It's a little distance outside, isn't it? Yes. But can you describe how Bruckner would have first seen the Abbey? Because his mother took him there as a 13-year-old, didn't she, to see if he could be taken on as a singer?
Bruckner was born in the small village of Ansfelden near Linz, and his father was school teacher. And Ansfelden Parish Church belongs to the Abbey of St. Florian, and there's also a Baroque parish house built by the same master builder who planned the monastery itself. When Bruckner's father died, he was 13 years old, and at this point, the mother of Bruckner had to look, how can I take care of my family, of my children, how can I get along? And she took him and walked to the monastery of St. Florian, about 2 hours, and introduced him to the prelate, to the provost of St. Florian, with the request to receive him as choir boy. And this, I think, was perhaps the most important decision in the whole life of Anton Bruckner. And you may imagine, perhaps, the widow Bruckner and the young Anton, or Tonal, are walking through the fields and forests, and then the approach to the monastery itself with this magnificent Baroque architecture, 204 meters long, a center of faith, culture, and arts, as well as a social and economic center, the largest organ of the monarchy, the heaviest bells ringing, and it's really absolutely breathtaking. It's like the approach to Castle Howard or something like
it
this.
Is, and it's so ornate.
I mean, in some sense, it's quite difficult for people who've never been there to imagine what it must have been like for a 10-year-old. The first thing has to remember that these big monasteries, these big Baroque ones built along the Danube, were a celebration of the success of the Habsburg Empire over the Ottomans. And it's the church militant, so they were magnificent. They were designed to be, as it were, not exactly heaven on earth with hair shirts, but heaven on earth with gold. Gold upon gold upon gold, magnificence. And they were all built on a hill. And if you were as poor as the Bruckners were, like school teachers are from then till now, you looked up the hill to the place you could aspire to. And it must be as close now to a little boy aged 8 to go into the chapel of King's College, Cambridge, when you have no impressions in your life. and to have your jaw drop to see that magnificent architecture, which is why I think he kept returning to it, both for his career and eventually to be buried there.
And this became Bruckner's musical home for, well, the next few years, and he was eventually the organist there as well. Do we know what kind of an organist he was? Because he wrote so little organ music. I mean, presumably this is because he was such a great improviser. He didn't yes. have to sit and write it down.
His self-image was to be the improviser and the composer of symphonies without church and without religion, as Rodrik said. And improvising on the organ, this was his veritable strength, and at the organ, he developed a remarkable personal style. Unfortunately, we therefore don't have larger organ compositions of Bruckner, except some early pieces which have more the character of counterpoint studies.
But you have brought a piece of music that we can hear to give us an idea, perhaps, of how Bruckner might have improvised. It's a fantasy made up of sketches of Bruckner's first symphony, isn't it?
Yes. He played in 1890 the wedding ceremony of the Archduchess Marie Valerie, the daughter of Franz Josef, the first emperor of Austria, in Ischl, where the summer residence was. And he proposed to improvise over themes from his first symphony. He revised in that time, in 1890. It originally was composed in the 1870s.
Well, this is Klaus Sonnleitner himself playing the Festmusik based on the Bardischl sketches on the Emperor's Jubilee organ in Bardischl. Just a short excerpt, obviously, but that's Klaus Sonnleitner playing some Festmusik based on sketches for Bruckner's First Symphony. And Klaus, before we go on, you're playing what's now called the Bruckner organ in the Abbey of St. Florian, and beneath you, every time you play it, is Bruckner's sarcophagus. He wanted to be buried there, and he's in the crypt underneath. That must be a very strange thing to get used to.
Yes. His relation to St. Florian was so strong that he came back every year in summer. He made a holiday, he visited friends. He composed in his room, always the same room. You can come there and live there. It's a guest room. I'm the guest master and have the keys for you. And he finished there the second symphony and also the first version of the fourth symphony we are going to hear then. And he arranged his burial place with the prelate of St. Florian because he wanted to be buried in a freestanding sarcophagus at the most prominent place in the crypt of the church, directly beneath the organ, which he loved so much and which gave him so much inspiration for his work. And every time when I'm playing the organ, I know Bruckner is still there.
And do you hear the influence of Bruckner's sacred music and what we know of him as an organist in the symphonies?
I'm sure that that his personality, his religious personality, is always in the background, but it's often instrumentalized. I think biographers and writers did turn this often into a one-sided description of Bruckner as the Musikant Gottes, you know, this term, the musician of God, perhaps a bit
They do it too much,
yes,
for you. Now, we could spend the rest of our time just talking about different editions and the revisions, particularly for the Fourth Symphony this evening. But you have brought us a couple of recordings, Roddy, when, including the original 1874 version, Roger Norrington's
recording. Can I prelude that before we hear it and introduce this? Because this, in a sense, is like watching Miss Marple meeting Poirot, because it's the most wonderful detective story which has gone on. And it's partly to do with the fact that Bruckner's lack of success, relative lack of success, until very late in his life, and then even so, it was not very, very successful, led to the fact that there were no real definitive editions of any of his music that were in print. Imagine, when Brahms gets it, he does sketches, he writes a final version, he revises the final version, and then burns the sketches. So what people perform is what's in print coming out of Simrock. This is not the case with Bruckner. For instance, in the Fourth Symphony, there are four versions, and he revised it substantially once and then substantially internally again after that. And from this, of course, it's led in the 20th century, which is really the time he came to people's attention, for people to try and arrive at a definitive edition. And you wouldn't think that was very difficult. Off goes a scholar, probably with a grant, goes into a library in somewhere, picks up all the sketches, works out the authenticity of the sketches, puts all the notes in the right place, puts the accelerandos in the right place, and the written, yeah, you would think so. The trouble is, while these were being constructed, another ideology was going on at the same time, which became much more clear in the 30s, and that is the rise of Nazism. In particular, the search for an Aryan symphonist, as opposed to someone corrupted in the city like Brahms and supported by Jewish critics like Hanslick and so on. So it got tied up with a kind of ideology, which is where, of course, people start to say this great sort of church piece and so on, even though the Nazis are not so keen on that. So when they appointed an editor of a new Bruckner Ausgabe to correct edition, they appointed a member of the party called Robert Haas. And when he came to look at something like the Eighth Symphony, into that he incorporated a little bit of himself. His solution to what Bruckner intended was based on what he thought Bruckner ought to be. This was all then undone when Haas lost his job for obvious reasons in 1945 and replaced by a man called Leopold Novak, who took a slightly different view of it. But even then, British critics like Derek Cook would say, oh, well, we don't need to bother with any of the early versions. They're simply sketches. The problem is that Bruckner put the sketches into the Imperial Library in his will and said something like, soon they will understand, i.e., the revisions which had gone into print weren't really what he intended. Nothing could be more complicated. So with the Fourth Symphony, there are four versions. The first one he wrote is in 1874. And until comparatively recent, you couldn't get a copy of this. But now you can get a recording of it. Because Roger Norrington, with the Stuttgart Orchestra, recorded in Stuttgart, did a performance of the 1874 version. And this is how the finale opens of that version. Maybe it's worth almost immediately hearing the same movement conducted by Furtwängler in an edition which will be played tonight from the late 1880s. And for those of you who don't know this symphony very well, it begins for the first two or three seconds the same, bum, 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 bum. Then the next thing you hear in the Norrington is a quotation from the beginning of the first movement. Bum, bum, ba, bum. Then after a while, you hear, when it reaches the climax, the tune bum, bum, drum, like that, that you hear, which is where the example has just finished. In the Furtwängler version, i.e. in the late 1880s version, what you're going to hear is the repeat of the opening of the first movement doesn't appear at all. He cut that out. He replaced it by this very grand theme. And when Furtwängler conducts it, you will notice that he begins very much as though he was in church, and then he gets rather excited, and he adds a rather exciting and thrilling accelerando up to the... The accelerando doesn't appear in the score. This is Furtwängler's invention.
That's a very different sound, isn't it? That's the Vienna Philharmonic and Wilhelm Furtwängler in October 1951. Probably quite a different sound to today's Vienna Philharmonic as well, who are coming to the Proms to play Bruckner's Eighth Symphony with Lauren Marzell this coming Friday. Roderick, we heard Norrington going back to the original score as close as he's prepared to for the finale of the Fourth Symphony. We heard Furtwängler in 1951, a very different approach and much more of that sort of grandiose late 19th, early 20th century tradition of Bruckner performance. And we know all the clichés. We know about these people saying that his symphonies are cathedrals of sound. We tend to look through stained glass at Bruckner when we think about his symphonies. Are our ideas of his music changing?
Well, I hope so. And certainly Norrington is doing his best to change our view of what that should be, and other performers nowadays, because he needs to be rescued from a particular kind of tradition of playing it. I mean, to some extent, Wagner was thought of as that, and if you trace how Wagner was performed from when we know he conducted, for instance, the Prelude to Meistersinger, he did it, and it took him 8 minutes. It took Klemperer 11 and a half minutes. For a piece which is that short, it had got slower and grander. And unfortunately, in a sense, Bruckner suffers from a reception. I'd have to make sure that we make the point about the difference between the Norrington and between the Furtwängler, and that is it's a different piece. It may be very grand, but the notes are completely different. So it gives us a very good idea of what he thought his symphonies might be by the revision. Or was it his idea, or the people who corrected his ideas and persuaded him? Or was it the idea of orchestras who did a whole lot of things without being told what to do? Can you believe it? So in a sense, a whole lot of things, untangling the web. And I think what I'd like people to be able to do is to re-look at Bruckner as a symphonist who stands in the line of Schumann, Mendelssohn, and particularly of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I think in some ways we need, as it were, to rescue him from being the embodiment of a sort of messianic vision. Not exactly a religious vision, but an ideology of a symphony that could last as long as the Third Reich. And it's hard to untangle the whole ideology to make him a real man living in the 1860s and 70s, hearing Wagner for the first time, deeply embedded in polyphony, in the music of Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven and Schubert. One of the most striking things about the Fourth Symphony you're going to hear tonight is after he's begun this rather, you know, the sense of the knights advancing or whatever the meaning of the opening is, you break for a moment and you're absolutely in a moment of Schubert. It comes from the Austrian countryside near where he lived. It has nothing to do with the vision of heaven. In some ways, it's an aspect which, if you perform it too sepulchrally, too much with the sense of, you know, this is a man writing these great spaces, you would miss that almost witty point he makes when doing these. And that's the thing I really like about the Norrington recording. Having stripped it away, whatever you think of the edition, it's sort of like Sidney Smith, if you remember, the reverend who made witty remarks, seeing two women shouting at each other from the top of two buildings. And he said, those two women will never agree because they are arguing from different premises.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thank you very much indeed, Roderick Swanston and Klaus Zonleitner. Was a discussion recorded earlier this afternoon across the way at the Royal College of Music, and the producer was Juan Carlos Jaramillo. And there are just a few proms pluses left before the last night of the proms. Look online or in the proms guide for details, and don't miss Klaus Zonleitner's performance on the Royal Albert Hall organ to begin Friday's prom. Well, you're listening to BBC Radio 3. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the proms here in London's Royal Albert Hall. It's hard to believe that after 2 months and 69 proms, we've almost reached the last night. By the way, I misidentified the encore that Christian Ihle Hadland gave us after the Beethoven in the first part. It was actually William Byrd. I ought to be able to tell the difference between my French and English keyboard composers. Byrd's Galliard from my Lady Neville's book. This evening, our visitors from Norway, the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra and chief conductor Vasily Petrenko, are conjuring up the atmosphere of 19th century Vienna in 1801 with Beethoven, which we heard before the interval, and now with a major symphony from almost the other end of the century, Anton Bruckner's Fourth, the one he himself decided to call his Romantic Symphony. You could call any of his symphonies romantic in one sense, so perhaps what he meant was the concept of courtly love popular in medieval high society, given the simple descriptive programme Bruckner provided for early performances, a vision of dawn over a medieval city in the first movement, a procession of knights venturing forth, then the magic of nature envelops them, and there's a hunt in the third movement scherzo. But it's hard to tell, given Bruckner's insecurities about his symphonies, whether this was a concept he cared about or whether it might have been forced on him by those who thought his music needed help to reach an audience. For our conductor, though, Vasily Petrenko, there's a bigger picture.
Bruckner, he really asks questions. What are we in face of nature, in face of God? What are we? What are the nature of humans? Of course, he wrote this program about mourning and then horn calls and the beautiful landscapes and the valleys, etc., etc. But I must remember, he was always a very faithful person. He spent most of the time serving church, serving God. As an organ player, as a symphonist, writing pieces like Te Deum, which is massive belief. And I think he also been raising for himself, first of all, those questions. If the nature is so beautiful, and if the God created that, why then we humans, we need to suffer? Why then we have so much drama and pain in our lives? Why can't we live in harmony with nature? And all that, especially in the finale, with all the segments, it's like a puzzle, this finale, and to bring it all together and to create this movement towards the final appearance of initial theme through all the fight for it. This is quite a big task for conductor and for the orchestra, but that's what he was writing about. I think he was writing about this eternal journey of human towards the most beautiful world and towards the most beautiful society, towards the fairest society, towards the fairest world, through the God, through the nature, or through the social things.
Tonight's conductor, Vasily Petrenko. Well, the Oslo Philharmonic's leader is Eliza Bodnes, and here is Petrenko to conduct them in Anton Bruckner's Romantic Symphony No. 4, which we'll be hearing in the Novak edition of Bruckner's revised 1880 score.